My Lord Baron?
A high musical voice called out from behind him. Sharp turned around and saw a female hybrid approaching him. Her name was Quavel, and like all of her kind, she was excessively slender and small of stature, less than 5 feet tall. Her compact, tiny-breasted form was encased in a silvery-gray, skin-tight bodysuit. Silky blonde hair topped her high, domed skull. The texture seemed to be a cross between feathery down and thread. Above prominent cheekbones, huge, upslanting eyes of a clear crystal blue regarded him in a silent appraisal. They gleamed with emotion, which was not characteristic of hybrids of any type, barons or not. Quavel had served excellently as a spy within the complex during Baron Cobalt's brief occupation of Area 51. If not for the intelligence she provided and her organization of a fifth column among the installation's personnel, Dreamland would have never been wrested away from Cobalt and his forces. Therefore, Sharp was kindly disposed toward her and greeted her with a warm smile.
Yes?
To his mild surprise, she returned his smile and swayed before him like a reed in a breeze. It was a ritualistic form of greeting between hybrids, the precise movements, an instinctive show of respect and submission.
I thought you might like to see how the infants are responding to the treatments.
I would indeed. Take me to them, please. I'm very interested.
Crawler remained where he was as Baron Sharp crossed the floor to a set of double swing doors. They passed through into a corridor.
I'm also interested in how you and the other participants responded to Kane's treatments.
Quavel's elfin face didn't so much as twitch in response.
It is a bit too soon to tell, my lord. If any of us conceived, we won't know for at least another month, perhaps longer.
She paused, the corners of her small mouth quirking in an almost imperceptible smile.
As you know, attempting to conceive in such a fashion, and with such a partner, is unprecedented among our people.
Baron Sharp wasn't certain if she was speaking sarcastically or being brutally blunt, but either way, he didn't care much for the implications. The Dreamland complex was far too huge for even its most basic layout to be depicted on a map. Sharp wasn't even sure how Baron Cobalt learned about its existence in the first place. He and the other barons presumed there had been data pertaining to it on the computer banks of the Cobaltville Historical Division. Because of the installation's sprawling size, Baron Sharp didn't even try to learn his way around, except for a single section, and even that was the length of the entire admin monolith if it had been laid on its side. Quavel apparently knew their destination, so Sharp followed her along a dimly lit corridor, past a number of computer-locked doors. He didn't know what lay behind them, and he didn't care. The corridor opened into a square room, nearly 20 by 20 yards across. The overhead lighting was as dim as the hallway, but Sharp's hybridized eyes functioned best in a soft, dusky murk. The room was filled with rows of little plastic boxes, transparent cubes with no tops to them. Quavel stopped by one of them and bent down. She picked up a hybrid infant and laid its domed, nearly hairless cranium against her shoulder. Sharp surveyed the makeshift nursery, noting with approval that the infants no longer lay listlessly on their foam pads, and only a few were still connected to IV drips. Most of the tiny children raised their huge dark eyes to him. Still, even though the infants showed more strength than the last time he had seen them, before they were transferred from the ruin of the Archuleta Mesa complex, he saw over a dozen empty plastic cribs. He avoided commenting on that.
They appear to be much improved. My congratulations.
Quavel inclined her head in a short, gracious nod, and the infant in her arms uttered a cooing sound.
I am honored, but it was the combined resources of all the Ville's medical sections that provided us with the raw organic material to reverse their deterioration. As it is, your congratulations may be premature. We have yet to stabilize every one of the survivors, and five of the weakest have expired in just the past 7 days.
How many does that make of the 2,000 in the incubation chambers in Dulce?
Only 15, my lord.
I suppose saving even those few at this juncture is an accomplishment. And once we have the cloning tanks installed and the blood purification system up and running, we may be able to avert this crisis altogether, particularly if we begin the harvesting of new merchandise as soon as possible.
Quavell didn't respond, and Sharp caught the slight expression of distaste that tugged at her lips.
Something disturbs you?
No, my lord.
She carefully placed the baby back in its plastic-walled crib.
Oh, yes, it does. You may speak freely to me. I am not as preoccupied with ceremony as my brethren. All of that bow, yield, kneel nonsense closes out of town, if you catch my meaning.
She cocked her head at him quizzically.
I'm afraid I don't, my Lord Baron.
He gestured dismissively with one long-fingered hand.
Never mind. Speak.
Quavell's lips seemed to tremble, as if on the verge of forming themselves into a frown.
Perhaps the quarterly harvests will no longer be necessary.
It was impossible for Baron Sharp's eyes to widen, but he lifted one of his prominent brow arches.
Why would you say such a thing?
Quavell laid her hands on her belly.
If any one of us were impregnated by Cain, and we carry a child to full term, the salvation of our race will lie within its hybridized genetic structures.
Sharp fingered his pointed chin musingly.
Yes, that is certainly possible. If there are children that are healthy, if so, we should be able to synthesize biochemicals from their blood and cerebrospinal fluids to bolster our own autoimmune deficiencies.
Because of those deficiencies, the Barons lived insulated, isolated lives. The theatrical trappings many of them adopted not only added to their semi-divine mystique, but protected them from contamination, both psychological and physical. Although all the hybrids were extremely long-lived, cellular and metabolic deterioration was part and parcel of what they were, hybrids of human and Archon DNA. And even though they were a biological bridge between two races, the Barons weren't precisely sure of the reasons behind the hybridization program. But Baron Sharp wasn't so blinded by arrogance that the irony was lost on him. In order to rule humans, they were dependent on the biological material they provided. Just like the caste system in place in the Vills, the hybrids observed a similar one, although it had little to do with parentage. If the first phase of human evolution produced a package of adaptations for a particular and distinct way of life, the second phase was an effort to control that way of life by controlling the environment. The focus switched to a cultural evolution rather than a physical one. The hybrids, at least to their way of thinking, represented the final phase of human evolution. They created wholesale planned alterations in living organisms and were empowered to control not only their environment, but the evolution of other species. And the pinnacle of that evolutionary achievement were the Barons, as high above hybrids like Quavell as the hybrids were above mere humans.
That way, at least, Cain will have balanced out his act of genocide to some extent.
He smiled at Quavell warmly.
Your service was splendid during the retaking of this installation.
Thank you. But without Cain's actions to supplement my own, the entire venture would have failed.
Sharp eyed her with a mixture of curiosity and humor.
You must have employed wiles hitherto unknown to me to sway him to our cause.
Only the truth, my Lord Baron. Cain seemed genuinely moved by the plight of the children, as did his companion, the albino female. More than likely, she was the instrument in convincing him to help us. A pity she was killed.
Baron Sharp knew that Cain and an albino woman had penetrated Area 51 and been captured. The girl, Domi, had been found by Quavell's little group of insurgents, while Cain was sentenced by Baron Cobalt to what amounted to stud service. During his 2 weeks of captivity, he was fed a steady diet of protein laced with a stimulant of the catecholamine group. It affected the renal blood supply, increasing cardiac output without increasing the need for cardiac oxygen consumption. Combined with the food loaded with protein to speed sperm production, the stimulant provided Cain with hours of high energy. Since he was forced to achieve erection and ejaculation 6 times a day every 2 days, His energy and sperm count had to be preternaturally high, even higher than was normal for him. Baron Sharp had learned from Cobalt's people in the installation that Kane was supposed to be special for a variety of biological reasons. Of course, the main reason he was chosen to impregnate the female hybrids was simply due to the fact male hybrids were incapable of engaging in conventional acts of procreation, at least physically. Their organs of reproduction were so undeveloped as to be vestigial. Kane wasn't the first human male to be pressed into service. There had been other men before him, but they had performed unsatisfactorily due to their terror of the hybrids. At first, the females selected for the process donned wigs and wore cosmetics in order to appear more human to the trapped sperm donors. The men had to be strapped down, and even after the application of an aphrodisiac gel, had difficulty maintaining an erection. Such a problem wasn't something a hybrid, Baron or no, was likely to ever experience. What made the Baron so superior had nothing to do with the physical. The brains of the Barons could absorb and process information with exceptional speed, and their cognitive abilities were nothing short of supernatural. Almost from the moment the Barons emerged from the incubation chambers, they possessed IQs so far beyond the range of standard tests as to render them meaningless. They mastered language in a matter of weeks, speaking in whole sentences. All of nature's design faults in the human brain were corrected, modified, and improved, specifically the hypothalamus, which regulated the complex biochemical systems of the body. They could control all autonomous functions of their brains and bodies, even to the manufacture and release of chemicals and hormones. They could speed or slow their heartbeats, increase and decrease the amount of adrenaline in their bloodstreams. They possessed complete control over that mysterious portion of the brain known as the limbic system, a portion that pre-dark scientists had always known possessed great reserves of electromagnetic power and strength. Physically, the Barons were a beautiful people, almost too perfect to be real. Even their expressions were markedly similar. A vast pride, a diffident superiority, authority, and even ruthlessness. They were the Barons, and as such, they believed themselves to be the avatars of the new humans that would inherit the Earth. But since they were bred for brilliance, all Barons had emotional limitations placed upon their enormous intellects. They were captives of their shared Archon hive mind heritage, captives of a remorseless mindset that didn't carry with it the simple comprehension of the importance to humans of individual liberty. Smug in their hybrid arrogance, the baronial oligarchy didn't understand the primal beast buried inside the human psyche, the beast that always gave humans a fair chance of winning in the deadly game of survival of the fittest. Visceral emotions didn't play a large part in the psychologies of the so-called new humans. Even their bursts of passion were of the most rudimentary kind. Although the tissue of their hybridized brains was of the same organic matter as the human brain, the millions of neurons operated a bit differently in the processing of information. Therefore, their thought processes were very structured, extremely linear. When they experienced emotions, they only did so in moments of stress, and then so intensely they were almost consumed by them. Baron Sharp abruptly seemed to lose interest in the conversation.
Yes, but both she and Kane are only humans. Regardless of Kane's help, he is still a criminal and must pay for his crimes.
My lord, I hoped he would be extended a modicum of mercy in light of his aid to us.
Oh, he will be. Before he set out in pursuit of them, I instructed Ramirez that if at all possible, he kill Kane quickly and not to let him suffer. Much, that is.
His pale blue eyes turned as cold as the mountain meltwater they resembled.
Surely you don't entertain feelings for him? Allow me to remind you that if not for Kane's actions in Dulsa, none of these horrific events would have come to pass. Due to him, the Archuleta Mesa complex was destroyed, and with it nearly an entire generation of our kind. He also was involved in the assassination of Baron Ragnar, and though I never cared for him personally, he was still a Baron. For what he did to me in Washington Hole, I bear him no malice, but when he declared war on the Barons, he declared war on unity. And my own feelings are irrelevant, as should be yours. It is an official matter of policy. Do you understand me?
Quavel had listened to Sharp's tirade without a flicker of emotion.
I understand, my Lord Baron.
See that you continue to understand.
Sharp turned smartly on his heel. As he marched out of the nursery, he sensed Quavel's unblinking stare fixed on the back of his head. The skin on his nape began to crawl. He felt anger in her stare and an almost complete lack of respect. Without that respect, there was no fear. And without fear, he realized darkly, the barons could no longer rule. They approached Thunder Isle at the tail end of a raging thunderstorm. Another storm front had moved back into the area by mid-afternoon, and Kane had tried to race it to the little island. Dubois' sailboat rode the roaring breakers at the shoreline, rising and falling, rising again. Waves lapped over the sides, drenching Grant, Kane, Bridget, and Dubois from head to foot, the salt spray stinging their eyes. Dubois kept the small craft on course, knowing how easily a swell could pile them up against a submerged boulder. As they drew closer to the shore, the violent buffeting ebbed somewhat. Crooked fingers of lightning broke through the cloud cover, glinting on the rippling waves. The flashes showed a rocky beach, which was surrounded by thick growths of tall, slender palm trees and heavy underbrush. They also saw, canted on its port side, the landing boat from the CG-47. Dubois skillfully steered the boat to the shallows near the rock-strewed beach. When the keel grated on stone, Kane climbed nimbly out, waded ashore, and made the boat fast with a rope looped around the trunk of a palm. Grant and Bridget followed.
How long do you want me to wait for you?
Dubois' voice was barely audible over the rhythmic boom of the surf and roar of the deluge.
Your discretion. Give us a couple of hours at least.
Kane surveyed the shoreline. It looked innocuous enough, but what lay beyond the fence of palm trees was a complete mystery. He, Bridget, and Grant entered the labyrinth of foliage. The men wore their suits of magistrate body armor, and the rain made it gleam as if it had been rubbed down with oil. They constantly had to palm away droplets of water from the visors, and Kane supposed they were lucky it wasn't acid rain. Although mag armor was treated to withstand prolonged exposure to toxins, a shower of acid rain, even if only a drizzle, wasn't something to take lightly. Both men had been keenly aware of the sudden fear in Dubois' eyes when they boarded the boat sheathed in black polycarbonate and their visages concealed by their visored helmets. They were now symbols of awe, of fear. They looked bigger somehow, strong, fierce, implacable. When a man concealed his face and body beneath the black armor, he became a fearsome figure, the anonymity adding to the mystique. There was another reason behind the helmet, the exoskeleton, and it was a reason all magistrates knew. Once a man put on the armor, he symbolically surrendered his identity in order to serve a cause of greater import than a mere individual life. Bridget herself still wore a partial suit of Tigers of Heaven armor, but she had dispensed with the helmet. When the three of them volunteered to go after Ramirez and the escaped magistrates, Shizuka hadn't objected, but she seemed loath to send any of her samurai with them. They didn't blame her particularly, since losses in the ranks had been high. Besides, though she didn't mention it, she obviously felt that the three outlanders should take care of their own. They more or less had led the invasion force to New Edo. Also, there was a matter of local superstition to contend with. In the short time New Edo had been settled, a body of legends had sprung up about the little volcanic island they referred to as Thunder Isle. According to what they had been told by both Lord Takaun and Captain Kiyomasa, a cyclical phenomenon occurred on the island. The men described lightning that seemed to strike up, accompanied by sounds like thunder, even if the weather was clear. They had no explanation for it, but they knew that on the heels of the phenomenon often came incursions of what the more impressionable people claimed were demons. The outlanders were shown the body of one such demon, killed only recently. Bridget tentatively identified it as a Dryosaurus, a man-sized dinosaur. She was able to identify other artifacts found on the shores of Thunder Isle, a helmet from the era of the conquistadors, and stone spearhead that resembled a Folsom Point, so named for Folsom, New Mexico, the archaeological site where the first one was found. It was evidence of a prehistoric culture many thousands of years old. According to Takaun, the phenomenon had been very sporadic for the past 5 years, occurring only a few times. Recently, a new cycle had begun, and it was happening with far greater regularity. Brigid had studied the isle through a telescope and witnessed a blaze of white light, far too bright to be a reflection. And if it had been, the reflecting surface had to be gigantic. She heard a thunderclap-like rumble in the distance, accompanying the flash. Kiyomasa claimed that a few samurai had been sent over from time to time. Some found nothing, some never came back, and some were found decapitated. Brigid had been very intrigued by the story, but not so much so that she didn't walk with extreme care through the undergrowth. The rain was very heavy, like sheets of shifting water, bowing down the vegetation and making the ground marshy underfoot. A stiff wind rattled the leaves and branches of trees. The sky was crowded with thunderclaps and lightning strokes. Unhooking the copperhead from the magnetic clip at his web belt, Kane clicked an ammo clip into place. As the clouds thickened, he activated his night sight mounted on the helmet. The image enhancer gathered all available light and made the most of it to provide him with one-color night vision, at least for 20 feet or so. Viewed through the treated visor, the jungle seemed to be lit by a lambent, ghostly glow. Where only black had been before, there were various shifting shades of gray.
"I'll take the point this time. Stay close."
The three people went carefully, doing their utmost to be stealthy, despite the vines snaring their ankles and the thorns snagging their armor. The footing was soft and marshy, and reeked with the rotten egg odor of swamp gas. A steady wind rushed over the island. The tops of the trees moved violently, palm fronds rattling. The wind carried the pungent scent of decomposing vegetable matter. Kane's eyes watched everything, studied the slightest motion in the dim jungle. He was especially on the lookout for tripwires or snares set by their quarry. He saw nothing, yet he had the feeling they were being watched. He was positive Ramirez expected pursuit by him and Grant. Kane was so occupied looking for traps, he stepped into a depression and very nearly stumbled. Looking down, he saw deep parallel tracks that had squashed and flattened the vegetation on the jungle floor. The outside edges of the prints showed a pattern resembling splayed, three-toed feet. They were twice the length of Grant's big feet.
"What the hell made those tracks?"
He raised his voice so Brigid could hear him over the incessant clatter of wind-whipped foliage. She knelt to examine the prints more closely.
"If you want an educated guess, I'd say a companion to the Dryosaurus."
"Another dinosaur?"
"It stands to reason if there's one such creature on this little island, there's bound to be another."
She frowned at the print.
"But this doesn't look the same as the feet on the Dryosaurus. The claws are much longer."
"That's just what I wanted to hear."
Brigid straightened and threw him a slightly patronizing smile.
"Relax. That print looks to be at least a day and a half old. Whatever made it isn't in the vicinity."
"I'll relax when we're off this rock."
Annoyance flickered briefly in Brigid's jade eyes, but it faded when he smiled in a slightly abashed fashion to let her know he meant no offense. For a long time, at the beginning of their relationship, it was very difficult for Kane and Brigid not to give offense to each other. Both people had their gifts. Most of what was important to people in the 21st century came easily to Kane. Survival skills, prevailing in the face of adversity, and cunning against enemies. But he could also be reckless, high-strung to the point of instability, and given to fits of rage. Brigid, on the other hand, was compulsively tidy and ordered, with a brilliant analytical mind. However, her clinical nature, the cool scientific detachment upon which she prided herself, sometimes blocked an understanding of the obvious human factor in any given situation. Regardless of their contrasting personalities, Kane and Brigid worked very well as a team, playing on each other's strengths rather than contributing to their individual weaknesses. The three of them moved on through the jungle. Wind-driven sheets of cold rain rushed down, mixed with tiny fragments of hail. Suddenly, Kane thought he heard the murmur of voices. He signaled for his comrades to come to a halt and strained his ears to hear over the constant pounding of the rain and the thrash of vegetation. He picked up snatches of conversation. Male voices, more than two, he guessed. He gestured to Brigid and Grant to continue warily. When they reached a thinning fringe of undergrowth, they sank beneath the fronds of a palmetto scrub and peered out at the jungle beyond. When lightning flared across the sky again, Kane saw four men wearing mag armor huddled beneath a canopy formed by the boughs of a tree. Since their faces were hidden by the visored helmets, Kane couldn't be sure if Ramirez was among them. Two of the men cradled copperheads in their arms. A voice, as sharp as a whip crack, shouted something behind them. Kane whirled, raising his copperhead. He saw nothing, but he heard a series of staccato cracks, and the palmetto fronds on his right were torn to tatters as half a dozen rounds ripped through them. Flying pieces of pulp stung the exposed portion of his face. Not really aiming, Kane swung his subgun to his shoulder and squeezed off five rounds. He caught a brief glimpse of four armored figures scattering in all directions through the overgrowth. Kane heaved himself to his feet, grabbing Bridget by the elbow and jerking her to her feet. She, Kane, and Grant rushed back into the jungle at an oblique angle to both parties of magistrates. They didn't bother with stealth. The storm was making so much noise, no one could have heard the blundering of a dryosaur. The three of them changed course, struggling through thorns and vines. They found a depression beneath a copse of brush and rolled into it, lying side by side. Kane didn't believe any of the magistrates had seen them alter their course, but the men fired blindly into the jungle anyway, sin-eaters and copperheads both. Bullets thudded through the air, knocking bark off trees and slashing through shrubs and branches. Bushes bent and leaves fluttered. Kane realized that his earlier sensation of being expected was correct. The only edge he and Grant possessed was that in the thick bush, the magistrates would have to proceed slowly or risk shooting one another. Their own mag armor was the best protective coloration. Bridget huddled next to him, trying to soften the frightened harshness of her breathing. The Colt Mustang in her hand trembled. They heard the sounds of men moving swiftly, if not noiselessly, through the foliage. The rain slackened for a moment, then poured hard again. The storm's intensity showed no indication of ebbing anytime soon. Water dripped from the leaves of the bush and down the backs of their necks. A lightning bolt touched a tree nearby, the electricity crawling along its trunk like fingers of living fire. The flash was dazzling, the crack nearly deafening. In that brief blaze of light, they saw the dinosaur. Even the examination of the dead reptile in Lord Takaun's palace couldn't have prepared them for the monster they saw, made even more nightmarish by its momentary illumination by lightning. The dinosaur was bipedal, 10 to 12 feet tall. Grinning jaws bared rows of glistening yellow fangs. The saurian snout bore a pair of flared nostrils that seemed to dilate and twitch. The head, bigger than that of a horse, was set upon an extended scaled neck. Huge, cold eyes like those of a serpent's 100 times magnified stared unwinkingly from beneath a pair of scaled, knobby protuberances. Two huge legs, almost as big around as some of the palm trees they'd seen, supported the massive, barrel-shaped body. A long tail trailed out from behind, disappearing into the undergrowth. Its wet hide bore a pebble-like pattern of dark brown scales. Clawed forelegs were drawn up to its chest almost in an attitude of praying. Bridget felt Kane shudder beside her. When the next flash of violet lightning flared, the creature was gone, as if it had never existed except in their imaginations. For a few seconds, Kane tried to convince himself that what he'd seen was only a gnarled tree trunk, its bark glistening with moisture, and his mind supplying the fangs and talons. He failed to persuade himself.
You saw that, right?
Lips compressed in a tight white line, Bridget jerked her head in a nod. Kane turned to Grant.
What about you?
It didn't look like the same thing in Takaun's study.
It wasn't a dryosaurus. What we just saw resembled artists' approximations of an allosaur or a velociraptor.
Something in the way you said that makes me think that if what we saw is either one of them, we're in trouble.
We are, if it gets on our trail.
Which one is worse?
Kane's eyes scanned the dark, dripping vegetation. Bridget shifted position on the wet ground.
6-1. I think we'd better stay put for a while. It's on the prowl, and predatory reptiles are attracted by movement more than scent. We don't want it stalking us, so don't move.
Neither of the two men objected to her suggestion, although they were impatient to get moving. Although Kane and Bridget quarreled frequently, he had the utmost faith in her assessments of situations, especially when they were bizarre. After 15 minutes, the worst of the downpour had eased to a steady drizzle, and the thunderclaps were no longer as frequent. Kane felt confident enough to stand. When the prolonged scream knifed through the stillness, he dropped back down again. The terrible masculine scream seemed to go on unbearably and then broke in gurgles and gasps. Interwoven with the shriek was grisly crunching, a series of cracks like the breaking of distant branches, and then they heard the triple jackhammer roar of sin-eaters on full auto. A deep-throated bellow sprang up from the direction of the shots and screams. It beat at the air, and the trees seemed to quiver from it. The roar was filled with rage, triumph, and death. Even when it faded away, it seemed to echo still. The shots and the screams seemed to stop simultaneously, and silence pressed down over the jungle again, an oppressive quiet, as if a giant bell jar had been placed over the entire aisle. Grant, Bridget, and Kane exchanged swift, grim glances, then rose to their feet, nape hairs tingling. Carefully, they began walking in the direction of the commotion, moving with as much stealth as possible. Both Kane and Grant reflexively strode heel to toe, as they always did in a potential kill zone. Kane, once more assuming the point man's position, used his combat knife to slash branches and lianas blocking their way. 14 inches long, the heavy tungsten steel blade was blued to mute all reflective highlights. The double-edged blade was honed to a razor-keen cutting edge. In the wake of the storm, the humidity increased. The air was hot and steamy, and sweat gathered on all of them. Kane and Grant felt as if they were wearing bogs under their armor. The smell of decaying vegetation blended with that of exotic flowers blooming in gold and crimson against the dark green of the rainforest. They came across a set of three-toed, claw-tipped tracks. The tracks were intermittent, but there were enough impressions to provide a trail to follow. They followed the tracks into the undergrowth. There was an eerie lack of insect or bird sounds. All they heard was the squish of the muddy earth beneath their boots. The jungle was thick all around them, the deep green fronds, the heavy-leaved interlocking branches pressing in everywhere. Even the sunlight that filtered through the branches held a greenish tint. Still, combined with the beams of their Nighthawk microlights, there was sufficient illumination to follow the trail. They entered a small clearing, and Kane started to walk across an open patch of ground. Then his point man's sixth sense rang an alarm, and he came to a full stop in mid-stride. He stopped so suddenly that Bridget bumped into him. She started to apologize, then the words clogged in her throat. The black-helmeted, red-visored head of a magistrate lay on the ground amid a puddle of crimson. The mouth gaped open in a rictus of slack-lipped horror and agony. The rear part of the helmet bore deep gouges where teeth or claws had scored it. The ground was torn up for yards around, and even the boles of nearby palm trees were splashed with artless patterns of blood. The amber beam of his Nighthawk winked on brass cartridge cases scattered on the ground. Kane swallowed the column of bile rising in his throat.
I guess that particular dinosaur won't be stalking us tonight, since he's already grabbed his evening meal.
How the fuck did dinosaurs get on this island in the first place?
The question wasn't rhetorical, but directed toward Bridget. She didn't respond.
Usually, you have a scientific theory or hypothesis for every phenomenon or anomaly, no matter how trivial. A dinosaur from the Cretaceous period running around biting men's heads off isn't a trifle.
She shot him a slit-eyed glare full of reproach.
Whatever theory I could offer wouldn't be very scientific.
You're sure it's not some kind of mutated lizard? One that only looks like a dinosaur? Maybe it swam here from a hell zone on the mainland.
Even Grant didn't sound as if he believed it. Hell zones were areas that were still hot due to lingering radioactivity or other hostile environmental features. Though fewer hell zones existed now as compared to 100 years earlier, when almost the entire continent was a Deathlands, there were still a number of places where the geological or meteorological effects of the nuking prevented a full recovery. Neither Kane nor Grant wanted to think about an animal, mutated or not, that possessed jaws powerful enough to bite through Kevlar and chew up a polycarbonate helmet. After examining the wet, marshy ground in the vicinity, Kane found impressions that he assumed were made by the magistrates. He also saw broken twigs and stems in the undergrowth. He followed the path, keyed up and anxious. Veils of mist drifted in from the sea, looking like wraiths, tricking the eyes into believing their quarry stood where there were none, but possibly disguising where they really were. The sun dropped lower in the sky, and a sickly twilight deepened over the island. There was nothing to see but trees and undergrowth, not even insects or snakes. Yet Kane's point man's sense felt danger, and the feeling increased so it was almost tangible. The close-set palm trunks were draped with loops of flowering lianas that hung like nooses. Soaked with sweat, Kane probed the greenery about them with alert eyes. He wasn't the only one who sensed an approaching threat. Bridget and Grant moved in silence, and even Bridget's poker face began to show apprehension. None of them could really identify the emotion they were feeling. An hour later, they were still walking, and night had fallen over the jungle, save for a narrow band of sunset glow along the horizon. but the heat and humidity didn't abate. They noticed how the fronds of trees and leaves of shrubbery were stained and spotted with livid streaks of yellow. When they breathed through their noses, the sweet, fetid stench of decay was so thick it was almost sickening. Breathing through their mouths was no improvement, since every inhalation of air tasted like a compost heap. Only Grant, whose nose had been broken 3 times in the past and was always poorly reset, didn't appear discomforted by the odor. Then suddenly the vegetation and shrubbery dropped away, as if the foliage dared not cross an invisible boundary. Beyond it spread a flat, sandy plain at least half a mile in diameter. Rising from the center of the dead zone was a dark, almost shapeless mass. On the far side of the circle grew thick, lush grasses and ferns. On the other side of the invisible boundary, the grass was thin and brown, little more than stubble. The dark mass took form out of the dimness. They went forward even more warily than before, blasters in hand, eyes searching every shadow. At first, they could make nothing of the black featureless shape that lifted out of the ground 1/4 of a mile before them. It was like a miniature mountain of black stone squatting in the center of the circle of dead vegetation. As they strode closer, edging along the circle of defoliation, details emerged from the murk. It was a huge structure that lay partly in ruins. It looked like a fortress of some kind, but of a streamlined architectural type. Made of dark stone, it rose in a complex of pillars and overhanging buttresses. Roughly cubical, the building loomed above smaller structures like a squared-off mountain peak towering over foothills.
That doesn't look like a city, pre-dark or otherwise.
No, it doesn't. Could be the ruins of an old military base.
Kane stared hard at the distant structures.
It doesn't look like that, either.
Grant went to one knee, gingerly probing the ground with his gloved fingers.
What could have caused this? Everything is green and growing on this side, but deader than hell on the other. Some kind of blight?
Bridget eyed the complex of buildings, and then the dead plain.
Some kind of radiation poisoning, I'd judge. You can see the energy pattern extending out from those buildings in a parabolic shape. I'd say the whole area is regularly subjected to short bursts of high-power microwave radiation. The bursts probably aren't over 2 seconds in duration.
She stared intently at the ruins.
There's got to be a transmitter in there somewhere, set to let loose an HPM burst at a predetermined time. Of course, the burst literally cooks anything in its path.
Harmful to us?
Maybe even lethal if we're unlucky enough to be inside its effect radius when and if it kicks off again.
She gestured, and Kane followed her arm wave with his eyes. Sprinkled across the barren and sere landscape were the browned skeletons of birds, their featherless wings outstretched as if they had dropped dead in mid-flight. Here and there were smaller collections of bones, like those of rats and other animals. Grant unsheathed his combat knife and tentatively stabbed the ground, working up a clot of dirt. It lifted out easily with no resistance. The blades of grass were lank and pale, the roots brown and dead.
Cooked.
The bursts must be part of the phenomena Lord Takaun and Kiyomasa told us about.
Her eyes surveyed the defoliated area.
Maybe Ramirez and his mags were caught in the last burst and cooked in their shells.
Like crabs.
Nice thought.
Grant straightened.
But we'd see their bodies.
Kane stepped over the line of demarcation and stood motionless for a moment. He exchanged a meaningful glance with his companions.
You can wait for me, if you want.
Grant growled deep in his chest and stepped over the line. Bridget followed a heartbeat later. They started walking, their feet stirring up bits of ash and powdery grit. They had walked only a few dozen yards when they came across the prints of many booted feet, all of them with a familiar tread pattern.
I guess we're still on the right track.
The nearer they got to the structures, the higher they loomed. They looked more massive than Bridget, Kane, or Grant had expected. They were made of blocks of a dark, stained stone that reflected no trace of light. Some of the smaller buildings had eroded so much that they had fallen completely into ruin. Roofless arches reared from the ground, and a few storage buildings were scattered around the outer perimeter of the walls. A broad blacktop avenue ran toward the main building. The asphalt had a peculiar ripple pattern to it, and weeds sprouted from splits in the surface. All three of them had seen the rippling effect before, out in the hell zones. It was a characteristic result of earthquakes triggered by nuclear bomb shockwaves. Lamp posts lined the road, most of them rusted through and leaning over at 45-degree angles. The avenue widened inside the walls, opening into a broad courtyard filled with great blocks of basalt and concrete that had fallen from the buildings. Secondary lanes stretched out in all directions, like the spokes of a wheel. Their eyes followed the spiderweb pattern of streets and picked out what might have been offices and pedestrian walkways. All along the streets, empty husks of buildings stood like skeletal sentinels. One of the structures had collapsed entirely, folded in on itself like a house of dominoes, with the fallen rear wall knocking down all the interior sections one by one. Only the largest building, the Cube, as Kane called it, showed little sign of wear. Its dark facade showed no windows, and when he looked at it, he felt an inner cringing and an icy touch of fear. A subliminal aura of evil radiated from the structure.
This layout is like the campus of a pre-dark university or a private institution. Or it's some kind of industrial complex, but that's not likely.
How come? The Western Isles were part of California, so maybe this chunk held a school.
Maybe.
She didn't sound as if she really considered it possible. On the far side of one of the secondary roads, they saw a section where the buildings weren't in ruins, although ruined areas joined it. Obviously, all of it had once been part of the same complex. The three of them walked without speaking, very conscious of external stimuli, the tramping of their feet, the faint sigh of a damp breeze. Kane's point man's instinct was conscious of something else. Though he couldn't put a name to it, his sixth sense rang a sudden, insistent alarm. He came to a halt, dropping into a crouch, swinging the bore of his subgun from left to right. He moved his head as a wolf did when catching a far-off sound or a faint scent.
Wait a second.
Bridget and Grant halted, eyeing him anxiously.
What?
A thundering full-auto salvo stitched holes in the wall opposite their position, showering them with rock chips and fragments. Instantly, they took cover behind a low tumble of concrete. Kane peered over the top and glimpsed two black-armored figures brandishing copperheads duck-walking between a line of ruins. Grant triggered his Sin-Eater in their direction, dousing the walls with a 9mm barrage that sent them scuttling back. Another volley of autofire blazed from the direction in which they had come, steel-jacketed slugs snapping over their heads like the popping of whips. Weapons stuttered from both sides, short pencils of blaster fire lighting up the gloom of the alleys. Kane looked toward Grant, who met his gaze expressionlessly.
The sons of bitches are trying to catch us in a crossfire. They'll be able to cut off our retreat. Bridget, get moving. Stay low.
Bridget hesitated.
Get going. We'll cover you.
Setting herself, Bridget took a couple of deep breaths and sprang away from the rubble. She began a fast, crouching run, paralleling the main avenue, angling toward a split in the walls. Grant glimpsed three figures fanning out two lanes over, dashing to intercept her. He triggered a long burst from the Sin-Eater. Red-hot parabellum rounds chewing up the asphalt around the magistrates. They scattered, diving out of sight. Rising to their feet, Grant and Kane sprinted as fast as they could after Bridget. Four mags moved from either side of the street to cut them off, two to a side, crouching in tight defensive postures. Their blasters began to stutter, and Grant stumbled from a triple hammer blow against his right hip. The rounds didn't penetrate the tough polycarbonate exoskeleton, but the impacts nearly knocked him off his feet and sent him staggering to one side. Gritting his teeth against the pain, Grant depressed the Sin-Eater's trigger, dousing two of the men with a prolonged figure-eight stitch pattern, toppling both of them under a blazing barrage. He doubted they were dead, but the kinetic shock might have incapacitated them. They began running again, Grant gasping in pain and exertion. They heard Bridget shout their names, and they swerved in the direction of her voice. Within a few yards, they realized Bridget was shouting an alarm, a warning. They only realized it when three magistrates materialized out of the shadows of a ruined building and jumped them. The mags were either low on ammunition or decided to outmuscle their adversaries rather than try to outshoot them. Long combat knives, mates to Kane's and Grant's own, sprouted from their fists. Grant recognized Ramirez's voice.
Fucking traitors to unity!
The man was a vilbred zealot, but he was also a pro. His training was evident in the fast thrust he made toward Grant's face. Grant used the frame of his Sin-Eater to parry the thrust with a clashing of steel and a small spurt of sparks. Even as he did so, another mag slid up behind him and knocked his feet out from under him with a fast leg sweep. He fell heavily onto his back. Kane slashed with his own knife across a man's neck, intending to open him up. The double-edged point caught and dragged in the Kevlar weave of the armor's bodysuit. The material didn't part, and the man grappled with him, securing a wrist lock. They strained against each other, faces inches apart. The mag kicked himself forward, the crown of his head connecting with a teeth-jarring, vision-blurring impact against Kane's chin. Kane reeled backward, trying to maintain his balance. The third black-armored man surged over the ground in a flying, feet-first arc. His thick-soled boots slammed into Kane's chest, bowling him over. Despite the armor, the force of the kick vibrated through the bones of his upper body down to the small of his back. Kane didn't try to resist the shock of impact. He allowed himself to fall, reflexively slapping the ground to absorb the momentum and minimize the chances of having the wind knocked out of him. He continued rolling backward and got to his knees, his knife still in his fist. Flipping it up, he caught it by the blade with accustomed ease, finding the balance. Drawing his arm back, he threw the knife hard. The blade spun once, then caught the magistrate in the throat, sliding halfway to the hilt in a narrow, exposed area between the high collar of the Kevlar undersheathing and the underjaw lock of his helmet. Shock twisted the man's mouth, and he fell to his knees, clutching convulsively at his throat. He made hoarse, gagging noises. Ramirez tried to stomp Grant's gun hand, but he levered his lower body up, arching his back. The thick treads of both boots pistoned out like horizontal pile drivers, smashing full into Ramirez's face. With a mushy snap of bone and cartilage, Ramirez's body careened backward. At the same moment, Kane got to his feet and used the butt end of his copper head as a bludgeon, whacking a magistrate across the torso, sending him staggering toward a wide opening between two sections of wall. Both he and Ramirez fled through it. Grant rushed to his feet, his teeth bared in rage. Ramirez's companion raised his voice in a shout, and a three-round burst roared from Grant's blaster. All three bullets found a target. He fell heavily and made no movement after. For a second, there was no sound but the rolling echoes of the fusillade. Then, from around the bend in the wall, came an outcry of startled voices. The thudding of many pairs of running feet reached them.
Son of a bitch!
A contingent of magistrates broke around the corner of the wall in a wedge formation. They came in a milling rush, at a dead run, firing as they charged, even before they had acquired targets. They spread out across the area, some trying to cut their quarry off from a retreat. Shots cracked and boomed. A bullet hissed past Grant's ear, and another skidded over his shoulder epaulette. He dived behind a stone support post, half buried on one side, his finger pressing on the trigger of his sin-eater. Three bullets took a mag in the visor, punching him between the eyes. Kane went to his knees behind the fallen column, and his two autoblasters began to roar in a smoothly synchronized rhythm. A pair of 9mm slugs hit a magistrate with a devastating 1-2 punch, knocking him completely off his feet, his sin-eater blasting thunderously into the air. A barrage of bullets spewed from four autoblasters, slamming into the pillar. A round fired from a sin-eater took Kane in the left shoulder and knocked him off balance. He fired his copperhead in return, and two rounds penetrated the visor of the man who had shot him, slapping him off his feet, his limbs twisting and convulsing. Kane dropped the subgun, feeling the numbness of the bullet's impact spreading from his shoulder into his arm nearly to his elbow. The armor had redistributed the kinetic shock, but some of the impact had leaked through. He saw Grant, still laying down a left-to-right pattern of fire with his sin-eater, fastball a metal egg with his left hand. Kane buried his face in his arms, bracing himself for the explosion. The sound of the explosion instantly bled into a grinding rumble of a stony mass shifting. The grinding noise expanded into a rumbling roar. A long section of a wall toppled forward in a crushing cascade of bouncing blocks and spurting dust. All the men were engulfed, buried by the tons of basalt and concrete. Kane and Grant crawled quickly away, shielding their faces from ricocheting chunks of stone. Kane fanned the dust away from his face.
Think that did it?
Grant wiped away a powdery film from his visor.
I sure as hell hope so. The only way to find out for sure is to dig up these bastards and do a head count.
Kane nodded glumly.
We sure have been forced to kill a lot of mags lately.
Casualties of war.
Grant pivoted on his heel and strode away. Kane followed him a few seconds later, not in the least fooled by his friend's callous pronouncement. Although Kane had come to terms with his exile, with his status as both outlander and traitor, he knew Grant still grappled with guilt. The peeling away of their mag identities, the loss of their mag purpose, had been a painful process and hard to endure. Grant rarely spoke of it. But the man was always stoic in the face of physical and emotional pain, and he was particularly reticent about revealing his grief over Domi's death. And if he felt remorse over the killing of magistrates, Kane knew his guilt about Domi was probably all-consuming. The change in attitude that had come over her before their jump to Area 51 wasn't a positive one. Usually, Domi was forthright, forthcoming, and very verbal. Kane had been on a number of missions with her, and she'd earned his trust and respect. But she had become taciturn, even insulting, particularly toward Grant. The short fuse of her temper seemed to have shrunk to little more than a wick. Right before Kane and Domi had jumped from Cerberus, Grant admitted that he himself was the reason for Domi's confrontational attitude. For more than a year, she claimed she loved Grant, but he was always reluctant to return that emotion for reasons even he couldn't articulate. Kane guessed Domi represented a kind of innocence to Grant, and he didn't want to taint it with sex. Despite the fact she was no stranger to it before being smuggled into Cobaltville to serve as Guana Teague's sex slave. He also figured Grant didn't want to do anything that might diminish the memory of Olivia, the only woman who'd ever truly claimed his heart. During their penetration of the Dreamland installation, Domi's change in behavior had become actually frightening. What little self-restraint Domi practiced in the past was completely discarded. Without Grant as the mitigating influence, the authority figure, she was unleashing all of her bottled-up passions, turning them from love to violence. Kane mentally shook himself, trying to drive memories of his last real conversation with Domi from his mind. When they were reunited after being separated in Dreamland, he had been astonished by yet another profound change that had come over her. He consciously decided it was past time to either stop thinking about Domi or talk it all through with Grant and Bridget. When he had initially expressed his inability to accept the girl's death with Bridget, he told her that since Domi's body hadn't been seen, he felt there was a slim possibility she had survived. Bridget's response, which he felt was a trifle insensitive, had been short and to the point.
Is that what it'll take to convince you, a maimed corpse?
Kane caught up with Grant.
Let's find Bridget and get the hell out of here.
We don't know if Ramirez is buried or not.
So what? Leave him for the dinosaurs.
Grant thrust out his jaw truculently.
I promised Shizuka we wouldn't leave a single mag to seed. We can't risk a single one of them escaping and making a report to Baron Snakefish.
We'll bust up the boat before we leave. I don't want to hang around here any longer than we have to, just in case there's another pulse of microwave radiation.
Grant opened his mouth to voice an objection. Then from the direction of the cube came a flat, hand-clapping report. Both men knew it was made by Bridget's Colt Mustang. Kane's heart hammered in his chest, and blood thundered in his ears. He sprinted around and through the maze of collapsed walls, outdistancing Grant as he approached the looming edifice of the cube. Two more shots split the silence, followed by a voice yelling something indistinct. The voice was undeniably that of a man, and the gunshots were undeniably those from a sin-eater. Gritting his teeth, Kane forced more speed into his pumping legs. His mind supplied a variety of frightening scenarios, all of which involved Bridget being either pinned down by vengeful magistrates or already dead at their hands. The very concept of her being dead always shook him in a profound way. He shied away from examining the feelings, except that he knew on a gut level that he had failed to keep her from being killed before. From the very first time he met her, he was affected by the energy Bridget radiated, a force intangible, yet one that triggered a melancholy longing in his soul. That strange, sad longing only deepened after a bout of jump sickness both of them suffered during a Mattrans jump to Russia. The main symptoms of jump sickness were vivid, almost real hallucinations. His own hallucinations seemed and felt like glimpses from past lives. He saw himself, and he saw Baptiste and Grant, and though they didn't look like themselves, he recognized them, knew them. He and Bridget had shared at least one hallucination, but both knew on a visceral, primal level that it hadn't been gateway-triggered delirium, but a revelation that they were joined by chains of fate, their destinies linked. Images from that vision spun in the depths of his memory. He saw Baptiste, a beautiful captive, dragged at the stirrup of a Norman lord's horse. Men in chainmail armor laughed and jeered above her, and long black tongues of whips licked out with hisses and cracks. Calloused hands fondled her breasts, forced themselves between her legs. Kane saw a man rushing from a hedgerow lining the road. He was thin and hollow-cheeked, perhaps 19 or 20 years old. His gray-blue eyes burned with rage. He knew the youth was himself, and Brigid called out to him, shouting for him to go back. He knocked men aside to reach her, and a spiked mace rose above his head, poised there for a breathless second, then dropped straight down with skull-shattering force. In all of those fleeting images, he had recognized Grant and Baptiste and all the bodies that had carried their souls throughout the changing ages. Always, in the bloody scenes of strife, their spirits were together, living and battling and dying, being reborn and somehow always finding one another again. They never spoke of it, though Cain often wondered if that spiritual bond was the primary reason he had sacrificed everything he had attained as a magistrate to save her from execution. The possibility confused him, made him feel defensive and insecure. That insecurity was one reason he always addressed her as Baptiste, almost never by her first name, so as to maintain a certain formal distance between them. But that distance shrank every day. Long months before, during an op to the British Isles, when Cain had protested to Morrigan, the blind Irish telepath, that there was nothing between him and Brigid, the Irish telepath had laughed at him. Brigid was his Anamkara, Morrigan had claimed. In ancient Gaelic, Cain learned, Anamkara meant soul friend. He wasn't sure what that meant, but he knew he always felt comfortable with Brigid Baptiste, despite their many quarrels. He was at ease with her in a way that was similar, yet markedly different than his relationship with Grant. He found her intelligence, her iron resolve, her wellspring of compassion, and the way she had always refused to be intimidated by him, not just stimulating, but inspiring. She was a complete person, her heart, mind, and spirit balanced and demanding of respect. Cain found the thought of losing that person too horrifying to contemplate, not just because of the vacuum she would leave in the Cerberus personnel, but because of the void her absence would leave in his soul. The memory of the kiss he'd given her when they'd taken the jump back in time to the eve of the nuke cost drifted across his mind. It was no surprise that he should remember the kiss, but the intensity of emotion associated with it shook him. He also recalled with startling clarity what the sister Fand of the third lost Earth had whispered to him about Brigid Baptiste.
The lady is your saving grace. Trust the bond that belongs between you. The gift of the Anamkara is strong. She protects you from damnation. She is your credential.
In the dark hours between midnight and dawn, Cain had often wondered that if he lost Brigid, lost his credential, would he become a damned soul, cruel, merciless, and without any purpose in life except to kill? Cain skirted a great leap of broken stone and debris and spied a single doorway in the featureless face of the cube. There wasn't a door, only a twisted, blackened metal frame hanging askew on sprung hinges. He gave the big plastic sign bolted to the wall to the right of the doorway only a single glance as he kicked the frame out of his way. The words were still legible despite 2 centuries of chem storms, fallout, and weathering. It bore a familiar warning. Entry to this facility strictly forbidden to all personnel below B-12 clearance. Below it, he glimpsed an unfamiliar symbol, that of a stylized hourglass. He entered a large lobby. The floor was thickly layered with concrete dust. The walls were black, speckled marble and showed ugly crisscrossing cracks. A litter of office furniture was half-covered by broken ceiling tiles. A big reception desk occupied the far wall, and it was nearly buried by plaster and metal electrical conduits. On the left side of the room, a hallway stretched away, lined on both sides with wooden doors. On his right, he saw a glass and chrome door leading to a murky semi-darkness. Though the heavy glass panes bore cracks, it was still intact and slightly ajar. Cain loped to it, shouldering it open, the unlubricated hinges screeching. The echoes of the metal squealing against metal rolled down the broad corridor and were smothered by the sound of full auto fire. Streaks of orange flame stabbed through the gloom. The stuttering hail of bullets ripped toward him, starting low and going high. Cain felt a numbing blow across his right hip as he threw himself against the wall. Extending both blasters, Cain pressed the triggers, smearing the shadows with flickering tongues of fire. Cain knew that sustained bursts of full auto only wasted ammunition, but his focus was on driving the magistrate to cover, not scoring lethal hits. Though he emptied both of his weapons, he achieved his objective.
"Enough! I've had enough!"
Kane recognized Ramirez's voice.
"Throw down your blasters!"
Within a couple of seconds, a holstered Sin-Eater and a Copperhead were tossed from around the corner.
"Take off your helmet and move out so I can see you."
Grant came pounding into the building at that point, and Kane spared him only a swift over-the-shoulder glance. The big man was winded and gulped air noisily. He pushed open the door, making sure to stand to one side.
"Who've you got?"
"Your old friend from Snakefish, Ramirez."
"Where's Bridget?"
"That's what I'm about to find out. Come out, Ramirez."
"No. You'll shoot me in the head."
He didn't sound fearful of the possibility, only annoyed by it.
"You smarmy little son of a bitch. I'd just as soon chuck a grin at you as talk to you. Now come on out, or I'll do it on general principles alone."
Slowly, Ramirez stepped around the corner, his hands linked at the back of his head. He walked toward them carefully with a measured, deliberate tread.
"Where's Bridget?"
Although it was hard for the magistrate to shrug with his elbows crooked and extended, Ramirez managed a fair approximation.
"How should I know?"
"We heard her blaster, then we heard yours. She's in here somewhere."
"Maybe so, but I haven't seen her."
Crimson flowed from his nostrils, coating his lower face. His lower lip was puffy and split. When he reached a point of 6 feet from Kane, Ramirez slowed his pace.
"You can stop now."
The mag kept coming.
"Why?"
"Because if you don't, I will shoot you in the head."
"No, you won't. I counted your rounds. You fired both your blasters dry."
As soon as the last word left his lips, Ramirez's right leg whipped up in a swift, spinning crescent kick. The side of his boot knocked the copperhead out of Kane's hand, sending it clattering against the far wall. Almost in the same fluid motion, Ramirez brought his arms down from behind his head. A combat knife was in his right hand, and he lunged for Kane's throat. Kane sidestepped, and before Ramirez could recover his balance, he pivoted, driving his elbow sharply against the man's belly. But Ramirez backstepped, and the blow didn't land effectively. It was still hard enough to hurt, and Ramirez was taken by surprise. Then, as Kane clubbed at him with his Sin-Eater, Ramirez jumped back and completely evaded the blow. Kane moved in cautiously, trying to get the mag to strike. He wanted to grab the younger man's wrist and wrest the knife away, but Ramirez was wary. He gripped the knife solidly with its double-edged point held upward, ready to slash at the first opportunity. Grant lifted his Sin-Eater.
"Let me just shoot him so we can get out of here."
Kane shook his head.
"He wants to take at least one of us with him. I'll give him a chance to get the job done."
Ramirez's lips quirked in a smirk.
"Thanks."
He advanced slowly, his teeth bared. He thrust with the blade toward Kane's shoulder and missed. Instead of dropping back, Kane took a swift sidestep toward the mag. The motion disconcerted Ramirez, who didn't have the time to get his knife in position for another attack, and he struck out with his free hand. Kane's right hand shot out and closed around his wrist. He pivoted at the same time on the ball of his right foot. He pulled Ramirez forward, hooking his left arm over the smaller man's shoulder. Keeping his weight on the pivot foot, he extended his left leg between Ramirez's feet. The mag fell heavily to the floor, but held his grip on the combat knife, and Kane maintained a vice-like grip on his wrist. Yanking the knife wrist upward, Kane slammed a knee into his chin, then brought the mag's elbow across his knee with such force that he screamed with pain. He tried to scramble forward to relieve the pressure on his arm. Kane twisted his arm, and Ramirez was forced to turn in the same direction or risk having his shoulder dislocated. Kane raised his foot and brought the heavy-treaded boot sole down on his adversary's wrist. He put all his weight into his heel, and Ramirez screamed again. His fingers opened around the handle of the knife. Leaning down, Kane grasped Ramirez by the hair and straightened, jerking the man to his feet. Measuring the man off, he drew back his left arm and threw a fist with every ounce of his weight and strength behind it. The blow caught Ramirez on the point of his chin with a sharp sound of a whip crack. The shock of impact jarred along the bone of Kane's wrist and into his shoulder socket. Ramirez's head snapped up and back, his eyes rolled up, and he lurched backward. He collapsed onto his back like a wet sack of sand. Trying not to let the sharp pain in his knuckles show on his face, Kane kicked the knife aside.
"Now we'll have to wait until the little prick wakes up to find Bridget."
"No, you won't."
Bridget's voice floated from somewhere above them. Both men cursed and spun around, leading with their blasters, their hearts racing. They saw nothing but the interconnecting rectangles of ceiling tiles.
"Sorry."
Her voice, finally projected, sounded as if she spoke from thin air right beside them. Eyes darting to and fro, Kane scanned the ceiling.
Where the hell are you? Are you all right?
I'm not hurt, if that's what you mean. Ramirez chased me a little ways, and we took pot shots at each other. I got away from him and locked him out.
Locked him out of where?
I'm apparently in a security office. All the vid cameras are functioning, and so are the comms. Just keep walking down the hall.
Why? All the mags are neutralized, Ramirez is out cold, so there's no reason to stay.
I think there is. Just do as I ask for once.
Kane exchanged a glance with Grant, who glowered at him. Then he shrugged and started off down the corridor. He ejected his Sin-Eater's spent clip and thumbed in a new one. They passed through a narrow door and went silently along an ill-lit corridor. The dim blue glow of the occasional neon light provided the only illumination. Kane looked back over his shoulder and saw the moonlight vanish as they rounded a corner. Presently, after many baffling turns, the corridor began to slant downward. At the same time, the hollow, echoing voice of Bridget reverberated from in front of them.
Just keep coming.
Within another few yards, the two men reached a heavy metal door without a knob or a latch. Machinery clanked, and with a prolonged hiss of pneumatics, the door slid to the right. They entered a room dominated by a huge flat-screen vid monitor. The screen was divided into 12 square sections, each one showing a different black-and-white view from a variety of perspectives. Bridget stood beside the wall display, the flickering light casting eerie shadows on the planes of her face. Her brow was furrowed either in consternation or fascination. Kane looked around.
The power is still on in here?
More than that. I believe this place was occupied until recently.
Kane came to her side.
How recently?
She smiled enigmatically and pointed to one of the squares that held the image of a wardroom or a galley.
Very recently.
A plate lay on a nearby table, as well as silverware and a large coffee mug. There appeared to be a partially eaten meal on the plate. Grant squinted at it.
Hell, that could have been there for 100 years. 200 even.
Bridget arched a sardonic eyebrow in his direction and put her finger above the mug.
And you say my eyes are bad?
Grant and Kane gazed at the screen and discerned a faint cloud of steam rising from the cup. Kane's skin prickled with goose flesh.
The coffee's still hot. Who was drinking it?
Who indeed?
Where'd they go?
Bridget shrugged.
They probably hid themselves when they heard the firefight. And there's more. Look.
Kane and Grant followed Bridget's pointing finger. The view seemed to be from inside a small chamber. It was circular, perhaps 10 feet in diameter, with an 8-foot-high ceiling. The chamber was six-sided, all the walls of the same smoke-tinted armaglass. The floor was patterned with interlocking hexagonal raised metallic discs. The pattern was repeated in the ceiling.
A jump chamber.